Hi, my name's Cameron Cozon, and this is the Lager Podcast, where we interview hardware leaders on their personal journeys and their career-defining hardware projects. But before we jump in, if you are a hardware team or if writing firmware is part of your job, then head over to LagerData, LagerData.com, and we will both literally and figuratively change your life for the better. That's LagerData.com. On today's episode, we interview Christina D'Avignon, currently a product design manager at Instagram, but before that, founder and CEO of the phenomenal Ringly, a New York City hardware startup backed by Andreessen Horowitz that created some truly beautiful products. I hope you enjoy our conversation. What I want to do is get to how you got to Ringly, but I know you were at Hunch before, and Akbar also said you did like music stuff even before that, which I had no idea, and I'm a little bit curious. So maybe you can just touch on music, and then we'll ease our way into Hunch, and then we'll get to Ringly. Does that sound good?
Yeah, sure. And I guess music was a foray into my entrepreneurial journey. Well, maybe I'll start way back. So I went to college and studied both fine art and human-computer interaction. I studied at Carnegie Mellon. So I was always interested in sort of the arts and technology and how they intersect with one another. But after college, was really interested in music, you know, moved to New York. I was working at a design agency right out of college, but on the side, loved going to shows. So probably went to, I don't know, a couple of like 4 shows a week.
Oh, that's awesome.
Indie rock was my genre.
Yeah, I love that.
Back in those early 2000s. And anyway, a group of us from college just loved going to shows. So we said, why don't we start a website that reviewed live shows so we can get into them for free?
Nice.
And we grew that. It was a side gig, but we grew that to cover 6 cities in the U.S. We had 50 to 100 writers, photographers who also loved music and wanted to get into the shows for free. So they would go and review the live show and they'd get their VIP pass. And it was just really cool. And we, we ran that for a little while. And then 2 of the guys who I was working with joined this music company called The Orchard.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Yeah. And so a couple of years later, they brought me along. And that was a company working with independent artists and labels to help them distribute their music, market their music, analyze sales, really, really help independent artists and labels run their music business. And it was interesting because they were so analog when I first started and artists and labels were physically mailing their CDs in. And then we had people like encoding the audio and uploading the files. So we built tools for them to do it themselves online and get their music distributed. You know, it was early days. So I think like eMusic, Apple Music, early streaming sites. I did that for a number of years, but all the same time, like I still had this entrepreneurial spirit and was working on a bunch of side projects. One of my partners from Loose Record, that small company, quote unquote, that we started to get into shows for free, he joined Facebook early on. So he was an early Facebook employee and started like, knew the industry, knew a lot of the venture capitalists out there and ran into a venture capitalist in New York, Chris Dixon, at a dive bar, I think, in New York. And Chris was...
I feel like that sounds right for Chris Dixon.
Maybe. Yeah. And Chris was asking around to see if he knew any good product people, good designers. And my friend recommended me to him, but I always thought it was under the guise of like, oh, cool, I have these cool startup ideas that I'm working on. I'm going to go pitch him. And I remember this was Hunch. And I remember I went to Hunch for my interview and Chris started asking me a lot of questions. I was telling him a lot about my ideas, what I was working on. Towards the end, he was like, yeah, so do you want to work here? And I was like, oh, is this an interview? I thought like I had no idea. So yeah, that's kind of how I got to start working at Hunch. And it was a great group of people, really smart engineers, product folks working on machine learning back in the early days and a recommendation engine. It was about 12 of us at the time. And I just love the energy. Chris was also angel investing. So we had a lot of startups coming through. I mean, I remember the pencil guys coming in early days, pitching him, and Chris would come over to me and ask for my feedback. And I think even Stripe, like some early, early companies. So it was all very cool. And over time, Chris decided to sell the company to eBay. So Hunch sold to eBay for $80 million, and I got to go through that startup acquisition by big, large tech company experience, which was also super fun.
And that's a big acquisition. I guess I didn't realize it was such a big acquisition. That's like a real win.
Yeah, it was big for the time. I mean, it was, again, during that time when a lot of acquisitions were happening. So it was exciting, you know?
Yeah.
We were all really excited about it. And even the supply team and stuff, they ended up getting acquired by eBay too.
Why did eBay start or stop acquiring things? I don't know. Yeah. It's like there's a little period where they hired somebody who really wanted to do that stuff. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it was cool because eBay wanted a New York presence. And so both us and the supply team helped kickstart that office and that experience. So it was cool.
Yeah.
Worked at the big company for a little while and still had that itch to start something on my own. Chris has been a good mentor for me throughout that period. And I would always pitch ideas to him. And I remember getting really excited about the wearable space. And Pebble had just launched on Kickstarter, this blowout, like $10 million. And these devices that are coming out, they're so cool, but they're so techy and they're so gadgety. And I really want this device for me that is cool and subtle and just tells me what I need to know without me having to look at a screen and without me having to look at my phone. And I had a number of, like I said, I had a number of ideas at the time, but that was the one that he was like, I think you should do the ring one. And then he's like, what do you need? And I was like, I don't know, engineers or something. He's like, all right, let me, you know, like I'll invest, let's do it. And I was like, whoa. But that was so encouraging and it really helped me get started. I was scared because I didn't know anything about hardware. I came from software background. You know, it was a design, so I love design. But I felt like I had built this whole network in the software space, just in the startup world in New York. I knew a lot of software engineers, didn't really know anyone who could help me on the hardware side. So I started just going to a lot of hardware meetups, asking every single person I would run into if they knew anyone who could help me do this thing that I wanted to do, which was like build vibrating rings. I think you were one of those people, actually.
Yeah, I was one. Yeah, I did. But not at a hardware meetup. We met. I was trying to think of who connected us.
I remember we met in Dumbo.
Yeah, at the coffee shop.
The coffee shop.
Yeah, that was fun. And I was like, oh, wow, that's a big idea.
That was pivotal. Yeah.
Let me ask you about these hardware meetups really quickly. So like, one, I think it's really interesting to know that you were aware of it being like a lot harder to do hardware than software. Like a lot of people that I sort of saw around that time, it felt like they were like, oh, it's kind of the same thing. Whereas like, it's interesting to hear that you were like, oh, this maybe is a little bit more challenging or it's going to be totally new and different than what I've been building. But I love the idea of going to the hardware meetups and like asking people. So were you just like super upfront with everybody about like, this is my idea, this is my background, and like, how do I get this done? And people were just like, yeah, generally helpful.
And I think there's sometimes a hesitation from startup founders to share their ideas because they're worried that they're going to get stolen or that someone else is going to do it first. But I learned through my time in startups that it's really hard. And so it's like, okay, great. If you can go and do it, that's great. But like, this is what I'm doing and I'll be your competitor. Fine. And nobody's really going to steal your idea because it's so hard to get started. That's the hardest part.
Yes. And I think even like staying with it, if you don't really love the idea enough, if you had to hear it from somebody else, I feel like you're just going to like back down at the first challenge.
There's this hesitation too around maybe these big companies will steal my idea and start working on it and they have all these resources. But through my eBay experience, these big companies, they take a long time to move. And especially with new things and with innovative things, it's hard to get products on the roadmap at some of these large companies. And so my advice there is just to not be scared and just push forward and get what you need done for yourself before worrying about other people.
Whenever I go into somebody's field where it's very technical and I don't know anything, I feel quite intimidated to like put that out there. And I've gotten better at it, but it is awkward to be like, you know, the thing that I don't know and I want it. Tell me how to do it. I'm very impressed by that. It's super cool.
I was just so passionate about it that I just ran around telling everybody and asking if anybody knew somebody who could help. And it was exciting. Yeah.
And so then you mentioned he said, do the ring one. And so one of my questions was going to be like, because jewelry is like a whole category.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask if you had decided on the ring in early on. And like, how did the ring come to the forefront of what you would pick?
Yeah, you know, that's such a good question. I don't know why it was rings. I really wanted it to be subtle and small. and discreet. And so I guess I went straight there. It could have also been at the time I was wearing a lot of jewelry. I don't know. I also knew, I think, that starting with the hardest thing would enable me to branch out and put it into bigger form factors. So starting small was definitely an area that excited me. Although in hindsight, I think it was, you were talking about how I didn't know how hard hardware was. And I think that that in my case was a good thing, that I didn't know how hard this would actually be, because I might not have done it.
Yeah.
But in my mind, and seeing the Pebble and seeing Apple devices, getting everything so small, I was like, we can do this. This is easy. This is going to be easy. I think it was good that I didn't know how hard it was actually going to be.
I'm going to just jump right on that one and we'll come back to it later. But like, is there one thing in your mind, one memory that makes you especially go, if I had known how much of a pain in the ass that was, that would have been like the deal breaker for me?
I mean, the form factor and getting it so small was really hard. Sometimes I'll even look back at the rings and be like, oh God, what was I thinking? This is huge. You could see some of my early sketches. I mean, it was like a tiny little ring. Then looking back, it's like, I don't know, would I have done it again? Maybe, but you know, we couldn't get it as small as we ultimately wanted it to, even though we really achieved a lot with how small we got it. It was just really hard.
And how beautiful you got it. I mean, it's a very cool product. I mean, I remember I had gotten one for my now wife, and Akbar had gotten one for his now wife. I had seen people wearing them, and then instantly it draws like questions and comments. Yeah. Like it really pulls people in. So it's because it did have that weird balance of being discreet and subtle, but also kind of eye-catching, which is like a pretty cool combo.
Yeah, maybe in a way it was good that we couldn't get it so subtle, because it was recognizable for sure.
So you have to build this team, and you're a designer, and you understand like creating experiences for people and everything like that. It seems like you have to assemble quite a broad collection of people to make something like this. What was the initial like four or five people that you brought on, and what were the main focuses that you had to like pull in?
I think the key people in the beginning was, one, someone to help me on the hardware side. And again, hardware is so broad. I had to learn the different types of skill sets you need on the hardware side, the electrical engineering, the firmware, the mechanical. And that was all new to me. And so it's really hard to find one person who can do all those things. But when you're a startup and you're small and you don't have any money, you kind of just need a couple people. And so we tried to get people with enough skill sets to help us get to at least a prototype stage. We knew we weren't going to get the working device, but like somebody that could help illustrate the idea so that we could then go raise money to hire the right people. Some of the engineers that I had worked with at Hunch went to MIT. And I had asked them if they knew anyone who could help me. And actually, one of them helped me early on with some prototyping, putting a circuit board together. A couple of them actually helped me early on, which was awesome. And they introduced me to their friend, Logan, who became my co-founder. And he has an interesting background because he was a mechanical engineer at MIT, but then went into marketing. So he hadn't worked in the field after school, but he was just a really quick learner. And I think early on, just like really smart people who are able to get their hands dirty and try to learn new things and new skills that you might not necessarily have was really, really helpful. I also, a couple friends from Hunch also helped me on the software side. So what we did was we tried to build a prototype on the hardware side, but I also designed and we built early prototypes for the actual app and what it would look like. And those are the things that we were able to bring to venture capitalists and raise money.
So like Dixon was like the angel who helped fund that stuff. And then you brought it to VCs. Is that the route?
Yeah, I was self-run for a little while. And then Dixon gave a commitment. And at that point, like as soon as he did that, is when I started going out and seeking more funding because, you know, I had momentum like with him backing me. And at that time he had joined Andreessen Horowitz. So it wasn't even him personally investing. It was Andreessen Horowitz investing. And so when you have a name like that, it's just a little easier to get more people on board. So we scrambled and dove right in and went out there.
Andreessen Horowitz is like a very big name now. Obviously, they were individually very big names. At that time, did it also feel like, holy crap, we got one of like the best investors around who invested in us? Or was it too early for that?
I mean, it was a little shell-shocked and maybe naive because I didn't know the venture capital world all that well back then. But, you know, I obviously knew they had a reputation. It was strong. We were one of their seed companies. So they didn't do a lot of seed investments back in the day. So that felt good. But yeah, it was exciting.
So then when you were doing the prototyping that you're talking about, designing the app and working with Logan, that was all bootstrapped, essentially?
Yeah, both Logan and I, at that time, we weren't taking salary.
Oh, wow.
Again, we had agreed to be co-founders, so we figured out what the equity split would be like. And he just wanted to change, so he quit his job, too, and went full force with me. But yeah, we did work together for a little while, I think while we were both employed, or maybe I had quit, and I was working out of the Skillshare office because I was on my own, so I asked Mike from Skillshare if I could take a desk. And he graciously gave one to me. So again, it was nice like being around that energy and having other folks building something. And then, yeah, Logan started coming and helping out. And we both went to all the hardware meetups, tried to meet people, tried to figure out how to get it done, get the prototype done, and even just see if it was possible. I think that we weren't sure. We didn't know if we could get something so small. And then I learned as much as I could. I mean, I learned about 3D printing. I printed some early prototypes of the ring on Shapeways and bought a Little Bits kit, actually. Remember that company?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Hacked some like little electronics together, put it in the ring that I ordered from Shapeways, and like had this vibrating ring. Like,
that's such a great combo.
Because I wanted to even see how it did. It feel weird to have your jewelry vibrate? Who knew? And so, you know, we tried again, do as much as we could with no budget and bootstrapping.
Did you have to hire like a jewelry designer, or were you mostly doing all that and that's where the 3D printing and everything comes in?
Yeah, we hired a jewelry designer eventually. I did some of the early sketches and I pulled, you know, ideas from Pinterest, inspiration. Because I think in the beginning too, we talked about being a platform. Once we got the tech small enough, it could fit into a number of different designs. And so we, you know, it was able to illustrate that. But then we eventually did, once we raised our first round of funding, we found a jewelry designer and hired that person.
So how long after you raised money did it take you to get to where you like shipped your first batch of product or things like that people could like buy and like use?
I think it was almost a year and a half before we shipped our first product. A year after we raised the money is when we did our pre-sale campaign. And so it took about a year to get to the pre-sale. I mean, we were building it during that whole time.
That's pretty quick, I think, for hardware and software.
I mean, we had a really big pre-sale campaign, so I don't know if we shipped everybody like 6 months after that. But we were shipping units by holiday season that next year.
There's something as like an outsider, like looking, like watching from a distance, your CEO style is, I had heard somewhere that like there are a variety of different CEOs and you can be like a product CEO or a marketing CEO or different things or whatever. And I just always thought you were so good at being like out there. If there was a place where you could at all fit in, like you were there. Was that something you like consciously did, something you fell into?
Yeah, in hindsight, it did. I think at the time I didn't realize that, but it's also just not something that comes naturally to me, which is funny. I'm an introvert and I'm a designer. I love to be heads down building. And so being the face and being that public was challenging. But, you know, I had a purpose and I had a mission and I had to do it because I knew that getting the word out there was the best thing for the company. Over time, it became more natural, but those early days were really hard for me.
Considering how good you are at it and that's like doesn't come natural, it's like almost like shocking.
It's not something that was that easy. But again, like once you do something over and over, it becomes muscle memory. But I definitely had some slip ups.
I am curious. Can you think of a slip up that you would be like, oh, my God, I'm cringing to that happened?
I mean, even in some like VC pitches, there were some curveball questions I would get that I just didn't know the answer to, especially in those early days. That's why when they say like go to the VCs that you're not as excited about first to practice, because it really is practice. I think my Series A pitch to Andreessen Horowitz, I left there being like, oh, my God, I totally failed that. but it ended up being fine. But it was just, I mean, it was nerve-wracking.
Those meetings are very hard to interpret. The more common one is people think that they nailed it and then they did not, and they don't get it and they leave like not getting information. So to hear the reverse story, very interesting.
Oh yeah. I'm a tough critic on myself. I think I mess up all the time.
You think that's like maybe a slightly designery trait too? Like, cause there is like
a lot
of perfectionism.
Cause we're maybe like always feeling judged or something. Our work is always.
Yeah. And there's like subjective, all answers are like that subjective kind of objective. It's like, it's subjective, but it is also objectively right.
Right.
Versus like, yeah.
You know.
So did you ever, as part of your process, did you ever have to go to like China or anything like that?
Yeah, I went to China quite a bit. In looking back at my experience in Ringly, that's one of the things I enjoyed probably the most is all the travel I got to do. It's not travel like you're going on vacation. I mean, actually doing business in another country. We were in both China and India. It was just fascinating. And, you know, I loved learning that new skill set and how to manage and design supply chains and work with teams out there and inspire them in the same way that you're inspiring your own team on the ground is different, but it's the same in that sense. So yeah, you know, at times I was like, oh no, I have to go to China again. But
yeah, it's not close.
But it was so exciting. I mean, it was just really cool.
Yeah. Could you just talk a little bit more about inspiring the people there who are actually ultimately manufacturing them? I've never heard anybody say that. It's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, and Akbar helped me with this a lot too. Like, you really need to develop relationships, because especially what we were doing was complicated and hard, and we were certainly not their biggest customer. We were taking a long time to get things out the door. And so, you know, I would meet with the factory owners a lot, try to share our vision. I would actually share some like press clippings and like,
oh, nice.
You know, how excited people in the US were about it. And like, this celebrity is going to buy one and this one's wearing one. There is an energy about it. And then also, you know, you're critical with the work that they do too, in terms of inspecting the product and making sure it's built right. And so you want to have a good rapport so that there's just a level of trust that you're building with them so that the product comes out the way that you intended it to. Yeah, it was fun. It was different.
Did the factory that you worked with like specialize in jewelry at all, or were you pretty much a super unique product for them?
No, and that was the challenge, because we had different factories who were manufacturing the jewelry, and then our other factories were doing the electronics, and the two worlds are very different. They don't really understand the other side. And so with the hardware, you have to be really precise, especially with our product, because, you know, we were fitting the electronics into something so small. The glue had to be waterproof. It's a waterproof seal. So the casing had to be exact size, and the gemstones were hand cut. So they had to be like very exact fitting. And that was so complicated because, you know, usually in jewelry, you're just setting a stone. Little small tiny gaps don't matter. But here it was just so much precision. And we had tried to, you know, build tools to cut the stones in a certain way, but really just that's not how you cut gemstones. You cut them by hand. So of course me. I was like, we're not doing plastic. We're not doing it. They have to be real.
Yeah.
It's so important. But yeah, I mean, it was hard.
I think that's a really difficult question. Like, looking back on it now, I could, you know, it might still be important. Like, it is fashion at the end of the day. You have like, you're fighting like so many battles here with this product that are like really, really challenging, and each one totally different. If you could go back in time, would you have just sort of said, fuck it, we'll try plastic first and then we'll go gemstone?
Yeah, or you're like, I think I was a little bit too niche focused in my audience in the very beginning, because I was thinking of the audience as me. And in reality, I think people would have appreciated something, because we ended up later doing sort of a lower end version. I mean, it's still $100, but we didn't use real gemstones there. We used synthetic ones to get the cost down. And that was our line for Target. And it just, the opportunity that that price point gives you is so much bigger than, you know, I wanted to be like the Apple of the space and put a product out that was, you know, people will pay $300, $400 for it. But in reality, like I wish I could have just reached more people and gone a little bit more broad.
With the synthetic stone Did you have any of the same problems of the precision cutting, or were you able to like basically spec that out?
Slightly, but it was definitely better and easier to cut those types of stones. Actually, this is a good story because when you're mass producing jewelry like this, natural stones all look different. And so it was really hard to teach people what was beautiful and teach the people building the product that this stone's more beautiful than this one. Because everybody has a different, you know, opinion on what looks nice and what doesn't. And so we're like, if this one has more than one line, then it's rejected. If it,
you know? Yeah, wow.
And so the synthetic stones just made the QAing process a lot easier.
So did you basically just have to dump a bunch of stones? You're just like, because like they're the wrong size?
And sometimes we had to dump a bunch of a finished product if the stones didn't, if they didn't catch it early enough, they would build the product with the quote unquote ugly stone. And we'd have to just dump or put that product on sale.
I guess you can't like take the stone back out because of all the glue and everything. So it's not even just that hardware is hard, but you picked maybe one of the hardest hardware projects.
It was ridiculous. Yeah.
Fashion, miniaturization. You're like, maybe we'll invent a tool to cut, like as part of your process, you're going to invent a tool to cut gemstones. That's wild.
Good lessons learned. But also, you know, I really believed that we could do it. And we did it. You know, we did it.
I think you objectively did it because you've made you made multiple products and you made like a bracelet. Like you made like multiple things and they're like, I mean, if you look back on that, do you look back on with like a certain amount of pride on like having made at least a badass product like that?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I still have, you know, boxes in my closet and I still hear stories from people. I was on a Zoom call at work the other day and mentioned, you know, that I was the founder of Ringly. And so I was like, oh my God, it's like a fangirl. Yeah. They were like, you? And so like those moments are so cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. Today's episode of the Lager Podcast is brought to you by us, Lager. The Lager Podcast people are talking about Lager. Go figure. If you made it this far into the episode, that means you're interested in hardware, which means you're probably interested in Lager. So go give it a look. Lagerdata.com, LAGERDATA.com. XOXO, we love you. Bye. In addition to all the hardware, you did build, you had a software team too, and you built an app, which I thought was a gorgeous app. Was it any unique challenges going from like all software teams to getting software and hardware to work together? Or was that like, do they live siloed? I don't know what that looks like.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's funny. I think it was actually easier for the software engineers to integrate with the hardware engineers than maybe the hardware into the software. I don't know why that was the case, but our hardware engineers, I guess, had just less experience on the software side and the mobile development side and the web development side. And so the processes are just so different that they had to learn from each other in that way. And, you know, I guess it's maybe because software, you can do things really quickly and you can iterate really quickly, whereas hardware just that, you know, it takes a lot longer. I think the harder part for me is that because our team was so small, I could never build teams of like a big software team or a big hardware team because we had limited resources. So it was almost like everyone played their one role.
Yeah. Team of one. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was hard because everyone likes to learn from each other in their own field and whatnot. But we were really a group of misfits for sure.
Did you, as part of like recruiting people in, did you have any questions about their like love of fashion or jewelry, or were you mostly just focused on?
Yeah. One of the reasons I was so skeptical to start this business is because it's not like even in my past, like I'm super passionate about fashion. I'm probably more passionate about technology than I was about fashion, but I was so worried that I wasn't going to be able to hire the right team to build this product. One, because it was jewelry and it was a product for women. And, you know, a lot of the engineers I knew were men, just to be honest. And it was just really hard to find women in the space. And when I did, it was amazing. One woman, early on, she was a graduate from MIT. She helped me tremendously in the beginning. She was also super passionate about technology in the space. Amanda Parks is her name. And she was just a big champion for me and for us. And it was just great to have a partner on that side. That said, I was pleasantly surprised that a lot of the engineers that I met were just up for the challenge of making this product and making and the challenge of making it small. And like some of the engineering feats that they did were amazing and enough, I think, to attract the kind of talent that we did. And then just my relationships with working with a bunch of people in the past and how we just liked working with each other and we had fun with the work. And that's so important.
I agree. Especially if you can have fun doing a hard thing. I think that's like the dream sweet spot of work. I love that. Not easy to get.
Yeah.
And so I have a question about the timing. I'm like, I don't like have like my years lined up here, but you raised from Andreessen and you mentioned earlier Pebble just did this $10 million thing. And like, I feel like there was a moment, and maybe it was just in New York, but I thought it was broader than that, where hardware was the it thing and people were all about it. And I wondered if, did that change? And then it did change. I saw a change where it was like, oh, you know, we learned it's way hard. Everybody learned the same lesson. It's super fucking hard. And we all thought it was easier than it was. Yeah, don't do it at all costs. So did that change happen while you were still running Ringly, or did it? Okay. And what did that feel like? And what were some of the like early indicators of that? Like,
happening? It was interesting. So Andreessen did put in a small check in our seed round, but first round capital was the investor that put in the big check. And Chris Frelick was my partner there, and he was just so excited about the hardware space. And they were investing in a bunch of other hardware companies, like Ring was another one.
Yep.
At the time, I think they were called DoorBot, but which is funny because then he had two companies, one Ring and one Ringly. Yeah. but yeah, they were really excited about the hardware space. So we got lucky in that sense, in that, you know, we were probably too early to raise money because we didn't have a product and we weren't out in market yet, but there was just so much excitement there. And I remember even one of the questions in my first round pitch was, what's going to happen if Apple does this? And I was like, Apple is never going to get into jewelry and the fashion game. They're an electronics company. And so I remember that very vividly. And they were like, yeah, you're right. And it's so interesting, like a couple years later now, seeing that. But yeah, so we had raised from them, and we had the kind of this meteoric rise. At that time, too, Kickstarter was so hot and everyone was doing these blowout campaigns.
Yeah.
And so we kind of jumped on that train and we hired one of the companies that did the PR for, I don't remember which one, that would like did millions of dollars in a minute.
Yeah.
But we worked with them, and then we had this huge blowout launch. It was sort of a formula. But, you know, it was a testament to people wanted it and it was exciting. And based on that, we were able to raise our second round of funding shortly before the product actually launched and shipped.
And so you got a second round in, you did a pre-sale. I also remember what felt like a pretty meteoric rise. And then, because like, to me,
oh right, the fall.
The fall, yeah. Like we're working our way up this roller coaster here. We're getting to the top. Yeah. It's like tick tick tick. But like, you know, if at this point, if I'm looking at it again from an outsider, brilliant. I think a great name. You know, you have the domain, a beautiful brand, a really cool app, a super cool product, a team that's coming together, a pre-sale like pay that went well. I mean, like everything seems to be like, you know, coming up pretty good. And so then, where did like the difficulty kick in?
The hard part was really in the manufacturing and getting the product to market fast enough for the demand that was coming in at the time. And so we had delay after delay. This is my fault. We underestimated just how difficult it would be to mass produce and ship to that many people.
Yeah.
Whereas I wish we were a little bit further along, but it was a chicken or the egg thing because we didn't have the money to continue on the manufacturing side until we did the pre-order, and you know, we weren't able to get the A until we showed demand. So it was this kind of game of proving that there's a market, but then not being quite ready to serve that market yet. And we were getting so much attention, but we didn't have enough product. And so, you know, at that point, people started to lose a little bit of interest. And then we would, as soon as we shipped the product to people, then we needed to raise the next round to produce the next product. And so we got stuck in this cycle where, in hindsight, I wish I had just raised money earlier. And I think now venture capitalists know how much it takes and how much capital it takes on hardware products. So I think we would have been a little smarter.
I think consumers have also gotten more accepting of those delays. because they've seen enough things go really long that they're like, oh, I get it. You know, I kind of won't do pre-sales anymore because I'm like, well, we'll see.
I know. We'll see when you get there. I know, you never know. Yeah. And there was, we've had some competitors that just weren't even able to get to market. So they, I mean, we were probably the first in our pre-sale to get out there. But then shortly after, we had a couple competitors in the jewelry space and they promised so many things and they just weren't able to get to market because it was, you know, we tried to start small and just be about notifications and communication, whereas our competitors were promising safety devices and tracking and mood and fertility. And so it was just, yeah, we knew that we're like, they're never going to be able to do that.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask. Cause like, does it make you nervous? Or are you like idiots? They got no chance, but I mean, it
makes you a little nervous because, you know, then all the attention goes there. Like, oh, they have this product. Or the VCs are like, well, they did, you know, X million in pre-sales and you only did this. And then, you know, when Apple came out too and Google, I mean, Google Glass, I think helped us because they went in the opposite direction where it was a really cool hardware product, but it looked really geeky and gadgety and bad. And so that was part of my story. So that helped us. But then the Apple Watch, I remember sitting there in a hotel room in San Francisco watching that announcement, being so nervous because I didn't know what it was going to be. And, you know, it was okay. I think people were excited about it, but it still looked a little techy, still looked a little big. And then, you know, the fashion world didn't quite latch on to it right away, which was good for us. You know, over time, they just had more money and could do more things and could build more features. And we just weren't able to do that. We weren't able to move as quickly.
Yeah. I feel like, well, let me ask you this. Do you feel this way? And I'm biasing it because I do feel this way. There's room in the future. There will be like Apple Watch type things and like Ringly type things.
I think that, yes, there will be. I don't know if it's going to be the billion-dollar industry that I thought it was when I first started. So I think there'll certainly be more devices. And, you know, once the technology becomes so ubiquitous, it could just be in like your clothing and sewn into the fabric and whatnot, you'll start to see some more interesting things. But at the time, we just weren't there yet.
Too early in a way.
Yeah, we're going to get there, though. I still believe it. We were just a little early.
As somebody who I think of as having like a tremendous marketing capability and the ability to get the word out there, what does it feel like emotionally to have to wait months and months? Like you're like, just let me sell these things. What is it like to like wake up on Monday?
You know, it was really hard too, because we had a marketing team and we needed to continue to bring money in the door to run the business. But, you know, we didn't have the product to sell. So we continued to sell the product until it was ready. But, you know, we would have just sold a lot more, to be honest, if it was available on time. At the same time, again, I was naive in just the amount of time it took to get to market because I hadn't worked in hardware before. And I was impatient. Anything over a year to me in the software world was like crazy.
Yeah, it really is.
When you're working at a startup, that pace is so fast. I mean, we were putting things out there every 2 weeks, you know, your 2 week sprints. And so I was just impatient on that. And I think I believed too much in myself that I could make it happen. And I think I did as much as I could. And we did get to market a lot faster than some of the other companies out there. But yeah, I do wish we had a little bit more time. Get it right first.
Yeah. So you're getting along, you're playing this basically catch up where you're getting product out and you're getting money, but you're kind of like bailing out the boat. We were earlier in our conversation, you were just like, but I had a mission and I had a purpose. And I was like, oh shit, you just had some CEO energy coming through. I was feeling really good about that. When you feel that way, and then you start to get this feeling of like, oh no, this might not be working. Like, when did that start to set in for you? And when did you start to think that maybe despite having released a cool product, maybe the overall mission wasn't going to work?
I think I never lost that sense that it wasn't going to work. It was just not moving fast enough. So I always, like, I still believed, like I was a mad woman believing in the product and how great it was going to be and how much people wanted it and needed it in their lives. And including myself. And so I never really lost that. It was just figuring out how to get it done. I think every startup faces setbacks. We were in a hardware incubator at the time and you know, we were getting to market a lot faster than some other ones. So it was also like nice to have peers. I mean, Jake, you mentioned that was on your show. Him and I were both in the same boat a lot of the time. It was just nice to have peers that were going through the same thing because you can kind of commiserate together. But yeah, we just kept pushing forward because, you know, I still believed in it. And I still knew it was going to be successful. It was just those setbacks were brutal.
Yeah. This is something where I think my memory is a little bit faulty. Like, what was sort of like the end for Wrigley? Was it, did you shut it down or did it have an acquisition or what was like the final, like an acquire type thing or what was the, how did it come to it?
You know, when I realized, you know, we probably could have raised another round of funding, but at that moment in time, it just felt like we were in this hamster wheel and, you know, we had the product in Target at that point. It was doing okay, but we would like to spend more money to promote it, more marketing dollars and everything. But I don't know, at that time, it just sort of Fitbit, they IPO'd and then it dropped a lot. People just started to lose excitement around the space. A lot of the companies, Pebble had sold, Misfit had sold to Fossil. There just like weren't a lot of players still at the time for that acquisition, but I did make the decision to go out and look for acquirers. We got close to the couple actually, but then through that process, we went through the acquire process too. We talked to some larger tech companies and Instagram, Facebook was one of them. And so they had made myself an offer and some other folks offers, and I decided to take it and wind the company down because I realized at the end of the day, like I didn't want to be a company that was selling this jewelry. We could have like shut down all innovation and continued to sell the bracelet and could afford my salary and some other people, but I didn't want to be that business. I wanted to be a technology company and innovate in the space. And there were a couple things that I wanted to do that we weren't able to do because we didn't have that next round of funding. And I think we were a little early. We were talking to MasterCard about payments and access, using your jewelry for access into the subway and never have to take out a Metro card again. And it's so funny. I think at the time that New York City was, you know, putting the technology in place to 2020, we were like, we're not going to survive till 2020. Yeah. That sounds crazy. Yeah. It was so far away. But, you know, I wanted to do a lot of those things. And we hit a point where we could have kept going, kept trying to raise that money to get there or just sell devices. And I didn't want to just be a marketing company, brand company and sell devices. So that's when I made the decision to wind it down.
Yeah, that makes sense. If I could say that back to you, it's like the mission and the purpose was like around driving the innovation in the space and continuing to push things. You had this fallback. You could just sell bracelets. The purpose is sort of gone from that, no matter what the economics are.
Right. So we went on. Made that call. And in hindsight, I think it was the right call. Again, I think that the space still has legs. I just think at the time it was not the right time.
If you could go back in time and make any changes, what advice might you give or what might you do differently?
I probably would have raised a little bit more money up front so that we could get the product to a stable place before doing the pre-sale. It didn't have to be perfect, but at least not a 6-month delay. I don't know, maybe I would have been a little less ambitious with my style choices. I was very passionate about, like I was saying earlier, using these natural gemstones and getting the product really, really small. And I wanted to start with rings and not bracelets and be, you know, this module that can pop into a bunch of different things. And I also think that I probably said yes to too many things and it was distracting. So because we were in the spotlight a lot, people wanted to learn about wearables. So I had, you know, CEOs of very large fashion companies, you know, I went to meetings with them and talked to them about the product in hopes that maybe we could do a collaboration or something. And those never really panned out. And so in hindsight, I would have stayed focused on our business and less looking for those partnerships early on. And yeah, I think the art of saying no when you're a founder and you're trying to get out there as much as possible is so hard.
So hard. I still don't even know how to do it. When you said like they mostly didn't pan out, my instinct was like, those are mostly not going to pan out. But then if I was in your shoes, I would take 100% into those meetings because you're like, what if? Like, I'm the CEO. I got to do everything. Gosh, that's tricky. There are like some parallels to the Jake Levine conversation. And it's interesting, again, outsider perspective, where it's a little bittersweet because the companies didn't work out. And he mentioned some similar stuff about being very strict about the vision. But then if I wonder if either of you were not that way, we wouldn't have these sort of like beautiful artifacts. So like it didn't work out for the company, but like you might have had a more successful company with like lame rings or something like that.
Yeah, true.
So I don't know. Since it ended up like a happy story overall, like I do like that there's this like beautiful artifact. Like I still have like the original Ringley like box. Like even the box that it came in was awesome. Like I think that's, you know, your box is good, but nobody wants to throw it out. They're like, oh, I'll keep this. This is like great.
And I had such a talented group of people working on that too. Bill Gaines is a designer that I've worked with. We both worked together at The Orchard. And then I hired him at Hunch. And then he joined Ringley. Never thought he would, but he did because we had just liked working together. He brought so much life to that packaging and the app and everything. He's just really talented.
That's back when like an app might do something new and interesting. Like I can just imagine like the swiping and I love it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think that's like pretty good story stuff. Is there anything that you think I should have like asked or anything you would have wanted to dig into more?
No, I'm trying to think any other like funny stories or challenges. You want me to talk about Akbar at all since this is his podcast or not?
Well, yes, sure. Let's do it. So one of the things he said to me, because I saw him for lunch today, he said, well, if she says anything bad about me, we're going to leave it in. And I was like, I'm going to tell her. I said, I'm going to tell her to tell whatever the worst thing that she could think about is. But yeah, I guess if there are any more hardware centric challenges or if there is anything that Akbar did that was helpful or unhelpful, something that he can take away for his learning as a CEO today.
He was amazing. I mean, he came in at a time where we really needed help with on the firmware side and the hardware side. And he had so much experience from Minna. And he was freelancing with us. And I never in a million years thought he would join. And it was like, again, one of those situations where I would talk to Tim, our CTO, and we were like, we have got to get Akbar to join. He is just so good. And I think it's that energy too. Like he started working with us in the office when we were working at a First Round Capital's office. And he was remote with his partner, John, out in San Francisco. And I think he just started to enjoy being with a team and seeing that excitement. He was there when we launched and we had so much like press and attention, and that was infectious. And I'm so glad he did. I'm so glad that he's starting his own thing now, because we always had that tension where he wanted to do things one way. I was like, you just need to start your own company then.
Yeah, I can imagine that. Yeah. But it wasn't just the press. I remember him being he was really into the product. Like he was really bought into the vision by the end too. I think he might not have naturally done it, but being around it definitely pulled him in, which is cool. And like everybody loves a great product. I mean, anybody who makes things wants to be a part of a great product.
So important.
Both the Ringley ring are, and the bracelet too. I like the bracelet a lot.
It was pretty magical. Like it was a pretty magical product.
And who gets to say that? Who gets to say they made that?
I don't know. But you know, it's funny because we were a product just for women.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't meet a lot of guys who know about us, but I do meet a lot of women who know about us. And and that's pretty cool. But like, I want the things that I make to touch everybody.
Well, being at Instagram is certainly a good way to do that.
Yeah, that's been fun.
Would you do another company? Like, would you try to jump back in and do the CEO thing again, hardware or software?
I've been asked that a lot. I definitely would, but I would have to have the right idea again. There have been two ideas that I really have. I've had a lot of ideas, but there have been two that I really liked, and Ringley was one of them. And then the other one, which is one that I started while I was at The Orchard, was called I Liked It First. And it was people can kind of like, it was actually right around the time or maybe even before the like button happened, but I wanted you to be able to like things and then it would record when you liked it. And so you could be like an early influencer. And I never started that company, but that was one of them.
Did you buy the domain?
Yeah.
Nice.
Can't give it up either. Yeah, it's been like 10 years. But no, I'd have to have the idea, because if you don't have the passion for it, oh my God, it's so hard. You have to believe.
So, but does that mean you have ideas that you're, because you do seem like someone has lots of ideas. Are you constantly saying like, no, that's not good enough, or no, you know, da da da?
It's interesting because I'm at Instagram now, so I'm thinking a lot more about the social landscape and the social space. But in my personal life, you know, I had a kid. And so I think like a lot of my ideas now are more around that space. And yeah, I don't know. None of them. I think because kids grow up so quickly, like I'll have an idea and then 6 months later, they'll change it. I'll be like, wow, that wasn't a good idea. You only get like a 6 month window for that to be interesting.
Yeah.
And so, no, I mean, right now I started advising a bunch of startups again, and that's been keeping me very sane and happy. But yeah, I mean, once that, you know, again, like once it comes.
Oh, I think you're totally going to do it. You're totally going to do another one. It really feels that way. Thank you so very much. I know it's a lot of time. I really appreciate it.
No, this is fun. Thanks, Cameron.